8 of the people killed in El Paso were Mexican citizens. Now the Mexican government is considering something rare, extraditing the suspect to face charges in Mexico. We speak today with Mexico's ambassador in Washington. I'm Marco Werman. We also speak with Jorge Ramos from Univision News.
For the first time, I sense that some Mexicans feel that it is safer to be in Mexico than to be in the United States.
And testing the limits of 3D printing technology in the housing market.
We sort of talked internally, can we 3D print a skyscraper? And we think we can.
Plus, how to defend your sandwich from thieves at the beach. Ah, yes, the birds of summer. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could be here. Ahead of President Trump's visits to Dayton and El Paso today, the White House said he wanted to reach out to both communities rocked by mass shootings. But in those cities, protests were organized and people raised their voices to say Trump is part of the problem and he's not welcome. Trump today accused his critics of looking for political gain, and he defended his rhetoric about immigration. U.S. officials say they're investigating the shooting in Texas as an act of domestic terrorism and say the suspect will face the death penalty. Federal officials in Mexico are also speaking up. At least 8 of the 22 people murdered at that Walmart in El Paso on Saturday were Mexican nationals. Mexico's foreign minister calls the shooting an act of terrorism against Mexicans. And the Mexican government is contemplating something rare, an extradition of the suspect on terrorism charges. Uncertain if the U.S. will oblige. But Mexico City is determined to at least follow through with an investigation into what happened in El Paso on Saturday.
We are appalled that an act like this was directed intentionally against Mexican citizens and U.S. citizens of Hispanic origin.
Marta Bárcena is the Mexican ambassador to the U.S. We spoke with her on a less than perfect mobile phone line.
The Office of the Attorney General in Mexico has started an investigation, and they have to do it by law. We have conveyed the U.S. authorities that we have to work against a discourse of hate and racism. At the same time, the Mexican government has already qualified the incident as terrorism, so that's why we are proceeding with an investigation in Mexico.
Ambassador, you talk about the indignation in Mexico, but the Mexican government's strong response, its shock to these killings, it rings hollow for many Mexicans. You can see this reaction on Facebook and Twitter. I mean, in Juarez alone in July, there were more than 130 murders, and that was an increase from June, with no comment from federal officials in Mexico City. So how and why can the government react so strongly as the homicide rates rise in Mexico and in Juarez?
I do not deny that there are murders in Mexico, but they don't have an intentionality to address or to kill one specific group. The thing that differentiates the shooting in El Paso from killings even in Ciudad Juarez is that that shooting was addressed specifically against a group, which were the Mexicans and the Hispanic community. And I think that makes all the difference. And at the same time, another issue that is key for us is the issue of the guns. We have been telling the U.S. and we have asked recently to reestablish a working group to have more control on the arms that are coming from the U.S. into Mexico and that are contributing to the high levels of violence in Mexico.
Ambassador, I understand your point about intentionality and the difference between violence in some of these places in Mexico and what happened in El Paso. But how can Mexico seek to protect its own citizens in the U.S. while it's partnering with the Trump administration on policies that actually put migrants in harm's way?
We need to work with the current government of the United States. And we have to work very hard, even in the most difficult times, to have a respectful relationship. In the case of migrants, we have had long conversations telling them that there are some cities in Mexico in which would be very difficult to accept the migrants for a long time because we don't have the conditions to have them for a long time. We have been asking them to speed up the process of adjudication of asylum claims. But I don't think we can relate the shooting in El Paso with what we are doing or not doing on the case of the migrants.
Ambassador, the bond between Mexico and the U.S. is so deep, and yet the border situation, as you know, the actual physical connective tissue between the two nations, it's under such stress. How frustrating is that for you?
For me, personally, very frustrating. You know, El Paso was considered one of the safest cities in the U.S. But the border, it's an area of great opportunity and of communities that are used to live together and to interact together. And this is something that we have to underline.
Marta Bárcena, the Mexican ambassador to the U.S., thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Marco. And I hope we will have better news for the future to talk about. I hope that this terrible experience will help us to go ahead for the better in the future.
Yeah, that is a hope we all share. Thank you very much, Ambassador.
You're welcome.
Later in the show, journalist Jorge Ramos of Univision News gives us his perspective from El Paso. If you've been following the news from El Paso over the past few days, there's a song that might have caught your attention. That's a young woman in El Paso singing the classic Amor Eterno, not far from the Walmart where the shooting happened on Saturday. As she sang, she was surrounded by signs like El Paso Strong and Forever 915, the area code for the city. Hers, though, is only one rendition of Amor Eterno being sung right now in El Paso. You hear it pretty much anywhere there's a vigil for the victims of Saturday's shooting.
Tristeza y de mis ojos que lloran en silencio por tu amor.
Amor Eterno was made a hit by the late Spanish singer Rocío Dúrcal, but it was written by a favorite son of the border, Juan Gabriel, a native of Ciudad Juárez, where there's a huge mural of him. Gabriel's song is often played or performed at funerals and memorials. One line from it goes, "How I wish that you still lived, that your precious eyes had never closed, so that I could see them now." And then it goes to the chorus.
Amor eterno, inolvidable.
Eternal love, unforgettable. Over time, Amor Eterno has become an emblem of sadness, now being sung by many broken hearts in El Paso.
Amor eterno.
All this week, we've been hearing stories of people waiting in Tijuana, Mexico, just south of San Diego, hoping to apply for asylum here in the U.S. Most of those asylum seekers are from Central America, but a growing number of them includes migrants from Africa. These are people who've made long and treacherous journeys to reach the doorstep of the United States. The World's Monica Campbell met one young man from Cameroon, now in Tijuana. His story is the latest in our series, The Waiting Room.
When I meet Valerie, he's 7,000 miles from home, going through a hard time. But he's finishing a meal that makes him feel better.
I'm always here because whatever thing I want to eat, I find it here. Like fufu corn and huckleberry, normally corn jama jama. Yeah, it's vegetable kind of meal. Very, very traditional.
Stewed huckleberry leaves and rolled corn flour served in a quiet, tiny restaurant on the ground floor of an apartment building in Tijuana. It's only blocks from the border. There's no sign. It's just called the African Restaurant.
When you first saw this place, this restaurant, what did you think?
I was like, oh, I'm home. I was very happy.
Valerie's from Cameroon. He's now been in Tijuana 72 days. He says he fled home because separatist and government troops are clashing and targeting civilians. He says he left his family behind and he's being cautious. He asks to use his first name only. Over the past year, more people like Valerie are heading to Tijuana from Cameroon, Ethiopia, Sudan, but also from places like Yemen. Valerie says he's even run into friends here from his small town in Cameroon.
Yeah, but when I arrived here, I saw some of my friends. I was like...
Some of your friends from home?
Yeah, yeah. Some of my friends from home, whom I thought they may be dead.
Valerie started his trek by first flying to Ecuador. It's a popular gateway to the U.S. because of fewer visa restrictions.
So from Ecuador, I started the journey up to Mexico, where I am right now.
He traveled by foot and bus. The worst, he says, was being robbed at gunpoint in the jungle in Panama. They took his backpack, passport, and cell phone. He says his friend was shot in the leg. When he got to Tijuana, he didn't realize there was a long wait list for asylum seekers just to see a U.S. border official.
I'm surprised. We are begging for a place to stay as a refugee.
The wait list has numbers. Valerie's is 3,500, and it might take months to be called. He's renting a room with others from Cameroon. It's cramped, so he prefers spending time at the restaurant. Also, he's between construction jobs, which he says don't pay much anyway.
They will pay me 200 to 50 pesos.
So 200 pesos is about $10 for a day?
Yeah, for a day.
So how are you getting by?
Well, I had some savings from there, so I'm just like managing. I eat once a day.
You're eating once a day?
Yeah. And a plate of food here is about 60 pesos.
So he's spending about $3 a day on food. Life's different than in Cameroon. He was a trained nurse there. Here, he doesn't have papers and doesn't speak Spanish. He also notices that when he works construction, he gets paid less than Central Americans and Mexicans.
You start asking questions. Yeah, why is it like that? Is it because I'm black?
Is it because I'm black, he says. A few days later, he finds another construction job that pays a bit more. It's some relief and makes sticking it out here just a bit easier. I ask if he knows anyone in the U.S. He says he has a friend of a friend there, no family, but he's determined to live in the United States. He points in the direction of the border fence.
Oh, God. That's freedom over there. That's freedom over there, but I cannot go there.
I ask why he thinks the Trump administration is blocking more migrants from entering the U.S.
I can't really say he has his reason for doing that. Like I usually say, in every good man, there is a bad part in him. Likewise, in every bad man, there is a good part in him. He alone knows why he's doing all this.
Valerie says, in the meantime, he'll wait for his chance to push through.
I need to go to where I'm going. I wasn't coming here to stay. I was coming here to pass.
For the World, Monica Campbell, Tijuana.
Tomorrow, in the waiting room, we hear from a young asylum seeker from Honduras forced away to Mexico while his legal case proceeds in U.S. courts. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is hard to keep up with the latest innovations in 3D printing, from smash-proof metal guitars made in Sweden to entire bus shelters in China. You get the giddy sense that there are no limits to how far this technology can go. This year, a wave of entrepreneurs are testing those limits by applying 3D printing to the housing market. Alina Simone has a story.
Do you hear that humming sound? It's the sound of a castle being built. A small castle, but still. No crew, no cranes, just a robotic arm squeezing out rolls of concrete mix like toothpaste, one on top of another. It was the first of its kind, but that was 5 years ago, and there have been many more firsts since then.
These buildings behind me were not built in the normal fashion, but were actually printed out by a 3D printer.
The Chinese design and construction company WinSun has printed a five-story apartment building, a Western-style villa, and in just one day, 10 single-story homes. The chairman even bragged his company could 3D print Donald Trump's border wall, 60% cheaper and in less than a year. Now this summer, an American nonprofit called New Story, in partnership with a construction tech company, is printing an entire neighborhood, 50 homes. But this isn't about techno one-upsmanship. It's about solving the global housing crisis, at least according to Alexandria Lofsey, the COO of New Story.
Could we build homes faster because there's a sense of urgency here? Could we build homes stronger because quality control is an issue with public housing worldwide? and could we build homes less expensively?
New Story's homes are designed for families earning less than $200 per month. That's right. This is not the United States. It's somewhere in Latin America. The company won't say exactly where. With land already provided by the local government, the company plans to finish the entire neighborhood in 6 months, and they're projecting each home should cost between $6,000 and $8,000.
Having homes that are safe, that are resilient, that are meant to, built to last, that are under $10,000, like that to me is somewhat of a magic number that unlocks housing access for, you know, close to a billion people.
Hearing about projects like these, it feels like the future is here. But for many housing experts, the question isn't if you build it, will they come, but can you build it where they want to be? The problem when it comes to making housing affordable, it's land.
The most difficult problem is land. You can't 3D print land.
This is Lloyd Alter, a former architect from Toronto who now teaches and writes about design and sustainability.
When you look at the entire community in terms of the plumbing and the electrical distribution and the roads and the foundations and the roof, the component that they're really adding value to by 3D printing is not that big a proportion. I have to question whether it's worth the trouble.
And Alter sees a lot of trouble here, including robots taking jobs from manual laborers. But he's not a total pessimist.
I think that there's some places where it would be absolutely useful and terrific. For example, the moon.
Turns out, NASA is way ahead of him. This past May, the space agency held a live competition to select the best 3D printed housing prototype for Mars.
First place goes to AI Space Factory. So.
If you didn't catch it, that was AI Space Factory, which bills itself as the world's first interplanetary design agency. Their housing prototype is called Marsha, and it looks kind of like a modernist beehive, or as CEO David Malott puts it,
you know, it's this kind of interesting egg shape.
On Mars, there's no one to object if robots take jobs, and land with a prime view of Olympic Mons is up for grabs. But AI Space Factory isn't just outrunning the problems 3D printed housing faces here on Earth, it's solving them. And when it comes to our environment, the biggest problem is the stuff most housing in the world is made from, printed or not.
Concrete is actually one of the worst polluters in the world, and it's the second most consumed resource. The first is water. So we use more concrete than we use food.
So in order to build Marsha, AI Space Factory developed a new material.
It's a biopolymer. It's made from corn or from sugarcane. And at the end of the material's lifespan, it can be composted and returned back to the soil.
The first test will be to see how well these machines can build in some of our harshest environments, the Sahara Desert, Antarctica. And if these tests prove successful, when it comes to the housing crisis here on Earth, the sky might be the limit.
We sort of talked internally, can we 3D print the skyscraper? And we think we can.
From here at AI Space Factory's Midtown Manhattan headquarters, it's hard to imagine a skyline without cranes, a street without jackhammers, a building without concrete or steel. But NASA's investment in space technology has yielded more surprising products, from cordless vacuums to artificial limbs to baby food. Maybe for housing? It's about time. For The World, I'm Alina Simone in New York.
One type of bird is a most elegant beast when it's soaring on the horizon. But the beady-eyed, ever-ravenous seagull can also be a pain in the butt, let's be honest. They're found on every continent, so it's a fair bet just about everybody has had to chase off a seagull or two, or three, while enjoying an otherwise leisurely lunch. Check this out, though. A British university student may have found a way to finally give our species the upper hand when it comes to fending off seagulls. The BBC's Jonathan Savage has the details.
It's a very common scene. A relaxing day at the seaside, spoilt by scavengers from the sky. All flapping wings, razor-sharp beaks, and screaming like banshees, seagulls swoop in to steal snacks right out of your hands. I don't know what you like to eat by the beach, but here in the UK, we're obviously very concerned about our steaming hot bags of greasy, salty chips. And no one is more concerned than Madeline Gumas from the Centre for Ecology and Conservation at the University of Exeter. According to her research, the solution is to stare at the gull directly in the eye.
Lots of animals find human gaze aversive, as they don't really like being watched. And if a predator is looking at you, it's probably planning on eating you. So it could be something as basic as that.
Ms. Gumas put a bag of chips on the ground and tested how long it took herring gulls to approach when someone was watching them, compared to how long it took when the person looked away. On average, the gulls took 21 seconds longer to approach while they were being stared at, enough time to take crucial action. But she has some other tips too.
If people must have their food outside, I'd recommend that you sit somewhere where you have your back to a building or a high wall where gulls can't have that sneaky swoop in from behind, that you're always sort of looking around, making sure that you're aware of where the gulls are around you, and you've got a good chance then of being able to avoid a gull taking your food.
Last month, a seagull was blamed for a chihuahua being stolen from his owner's garden in the southeast of England, causing at least one local politician to call for a cull. Some cafes offer customers water pistols to drive the birds away. But the number of British seaside gulls has actually fallen by 60% in recent years. They're moving to city centres instead. Seagulls are here to stay. Hold on to your chips.
The BBC's Jonathan Savage with that advice for those of us in bad relationships with seagulls. News headlines are a minute away. You're listening to The World. Afghanistan peace talks continue, but so does violence against civilians.
Let's find a way to live together, to respect one another, to have a dignified life as a united Afghanistan.
Roya Rahmani is the Afghan ambassador in Washington. Her take on the talks between America and the Taliban, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. A car bomb exploded in Kabul, Afghanistan today, a reminder that it is still a country at war. The Taliban took responsibility, but the Taliban is also involved in peace negotiations with the U.S. This week, U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad wrapped up the latest round of meetings with the Taliban in Doha in the Gulf state of Qatar. Khalilzad sounded optimistic, tweeting that they have made excellent progress. Meanwhile, the Afghan government has mostly been watching these negotiations from the sidelines because the Taliban won't sit down with Afghan officials. So what is the view of the Afghan government of these negotiations? The World's Shirin Jafari sat down recently with Afghanistan's ambassador to the U.S. When was this, Shirin?
Yeah, I met Ambassador Roya Rahmani on Monday, just as the U.S. Special Envoy Khalilzad was wrapping up his latest round of talks in Doha. I sat down with Ambassador Rahmani in her personal library at the Embassy of Afghanistan in Washington, D.C.
And the rugs, they're Afghan?
Yes, they are. It's a spacious room, and the first thing that caught my attention was the beautiful Persian and Afghan carpets that covered the floor.
We can set up here.
I should point out that Roya Rahmani is the first woman to represent Afghanistan as an ambassador to the U.S. She took office last December, so she's been in this position less than a year. And so I set up my recorder and my mic in the library, and a few minutes later, she came in.
Salam.
Nice to see you again. Nice
and we started chatting.
Let's start off with the peace talks. U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has held 8 rounds of talks with the Taliban so far. What's your assessment of these negotiations?
Thank you for this opportunity. It's good to see you too. The fact that peace is the highest desire of all Afghan people, there is no doubt about it. It is something that we have wanted, and we are in complete support of it, and we want and appreciate all the efforts made towards the peace process. For us, what's important is that these negotiations will result in a durable, sustainable, acceptable peace for all.
Do you think that the Taliban is negotiating in good faith, or is it just that they want the U.S. to leave the country?
It's a good question, because peace negotiations are always very complicated and also very delicate. What we need to continue to remember as we are moving forward these negotiations, what each side's objectives are and why. If the Taliban are insisting on the withdrawal of the foreign troops, what is it that they are really after?
Do you have an answer to that question?
Well, I do not, because as you know, up to now, there hasn't been direct talks between the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban. And I believe that that is absolutely essential for this deal to succeed. If there should be a deal, it has to be based on the talks between the elected representative or legitimate representative of the Afghan people and the other side. There are actually some foundational points that are accepted by all parties. Of course, we do not want to be dependent on any country for our defense and security forever. Right now, it's the Afghan security forces that are carrying the combat against terrorism. It's not only the Taliban. There is a lot more groups that are fighting in Afghanistan.
Right. And so President Trump has said recently that he wants to pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by 2020. Does that concern you, given what you just said, that there are other extremist groups beside the Taliban, for example, the Islamic State, in Afghanistan? Do you think the Afghan army and the Afghan security forces are capable of securing the country?
Of course, President Trump has been very vocal about his desire not wanting American troops to continue the fight in Afghanistan. He has been always saying that. You have probably also heard his interview with the Fox News, where he said that it is the threat of the terrorism that compels him to stay there. Whether I am concerned about the threat of the terrorism and Afghanistan becoming a breeding ground for terrorist activities or extremist ideologies, it should not be only my concern. It should be the concern that everybody should have.
Ambassador, what's your own experience with the Taliban? Did you live in Afghanistan when the Taliban was in power?
When the Taliban were empowered, we were living in Pakistan in exile because we were forced out prior to that due to the infightings in 1993. However, I did visit. I was a young woman then, and then I was, to be honest, it was one of my worst experiences in my life. I found my city, Kabul, where I was born, a ghost city. There was no hope. Women were not able to go school, work, travel, nothing.
So if the U.S. troops and the foreign troops pull out, do you think there's a guarantee that the Taliban does not go back to the way it governed Afghanistan in the 1990s, for example, in terms of women's rights and, you know, the harsh Islamic rules that they imposed on Afghanistan? Is there a guarantee once the U.S. leaves that the Taliban doesn't go back to the way it used to rule Afghanistan?
The guarantee is the political system that we have established. The republic system is the system that the Afghan people have demonstrated their unbeatable resolve to. There is one important point not to forget, and we are hoping that this point is also shared by the Taliban, and that is, let's find a way to live together, to respect one another, to have a dignified life as a united Afghanistan.
And with that, Marco, I was told by the ambassador's press team that I had to wrap up the interview because she had to get to her next appointment.
Fascinating discussion. What did you come away with, though, after speaking with the ambassador, Shirin? What's a big headline for you?
In general, I came away with the sense that the way she sees it, there is no military solution to winning the war in Afghanistan, and that the only option for ending this decades-old war is to negotiate a peace deal with the Taliban. Now, whether the group is willing to loosen its old, strict ideology, that's somewhat unclear to her. But the ambassador is hopeful that eventually all sides come together and come up with an agreement that puts an end to all the bloodshed in Afghanistan, and like the bombing that we saw today.
The world, Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for bringing us this interview.
You're welcome, Marco.
Ambassador Rahmani also told Shirin what the Afghan government is doing to stop ISIS there. Listen to the extended interview at theworld.org. Human rights groups in Turkey say thousands of asylum seekers there have been rounded up, and some of them have been forced to sign voluntary deportation papers to places like Afghanistan and Syria. The Turkish government is also ramping up a campaign to verify IDs at checkpoints and bus stations. As Duri Buskarin reports, some Syrians in Turkey who don't have valid residency permits are hiding at home now rather than risk being deported.
The apartment has sloped ceilings, warmed by a golden afternoon light. But even home can feel like a cage.
It kills you, the waiting.
A 26-year-old architect says the past weeks have been a nightmare. Last week, his boss told him to stop coming in to work.
It really changed the way you move. Even this morning when I went to get some bread, actually, like when you go to an ATM machine, it's really like terrifying. It's always in your mind.
We won't share his name or his hometown in Syria. That's because the permit that granted him legal residency in Turkey expired after he graduated from a university in Istanbul. He tried to register again with no luck, despite hiring lawyers, paying bribes.
I'm just stuck.
Sometimes, he says, when a migration official tells him he can't get legal residency here, he starts to lose it.
I get somehow rude with them, like, you are telling me now to go away, and if some police checkpoint gets me, that they will get me into Syria, to the place where hundreds of people die daily.
The answer is always the same.
And the guy says, yeah, it's okay, it's not my problem. So this is the answer, the normal answer you get.
About 900,000 Syrians live in Istanbul, Turkey's largest city. The majority have permits that allow them to stay here. But Turkish law requires refugees to stay in the districts where they are registered, and registrations in Istanbul closed back in 2018. Last month, Syrian activists in Turkey began getting calls from people in the northern districts of Idlib and northern Aleppo, claiming they had been picked up in Turkey without valid residency cards and forced to sign papers agreeing to return to Syria. Videos posted to social media show men on buses, handcuffed with plastic zip ties. The Turkish government says it's part of a crackdown on illegal migration. It started just weeks after the ruling party lost a contentious local election, and as Turkish public opinion has shifted against Syrian refugees. So far, officials have denied that Syrians are being deported to a war zone. In Fatih, an Istanbul neighborhood with many Syrian restaurants and shops, a weekly market seems a bit subdued. Your ID might be checked here, or at a bus stop, or just on the street. Syrian men are often targeted, their papers scrutinized for an expiration date and correct province. Some families have decided it's easier to leave their jobs and homes and move out of Istanbul.
Moving every day.
Muath Youssef is an IT worker and Syrian activist. He says he's fielding hundreds of calls from terrified refugees.
They know I'm trying to contact the Turkish government and to find a solution. They send me every day. I receive more than 100 stories.
He's heard from families where the parents have registration cards in one city, but their children are registered in another. People who traveled to Istanbul for medical care and may not be allowed to stay. Primary breadwinners who fear they won't get another job if they're forced to leave the city. For the unregistered architect, life is on hold. He avoids going outside. He can't get on a bus.
When you have like a lot in your mind to do, when you have a lot of plans, a lot of things to arrange.
His fiance is registered in another Turkish province, so they can only see each other on short visits. Her family won't allow them to marry and move in together until he has a legal permit to stay in Turkey.
So at this point, you don't know even if you will stay, if you will have your wedding, or if you will get married at all, or you will live to live in this home.
For The World, Duri Buskarin, Istanbul.
Coca-Cola is in the midst of an uproar in Hungary. An ad campaign from Coke shows same-sex couples kissing with the words "zero sugar, zero prejudice." That sparked a protest petition and a boycott of Coca-Cola by Hungary's conservative politicians. But the company is not backing down. Tamás Dombos is with the Hatter Gay Rights Group in Budapest. And just a quick heads up, Dombos has been the object of hate speech, and he describes in our interview some of the insults he's faced. There are already calls for a boycott. An online petition to ban the ads has already garnered 50,000 signatures. How much support is there for gay rights in Hungary?
Well, Hungarian society is very divided on the issue of LGBTQI rights. There is a significant portion of the population that is fully accepting. They support LGBTQI family members, colleagues and friends, and even issues such as marriage equality or adoption. However, there is also another part of the society which is getting more and more vocal, who is strongly opposing to any rights to LGBTQI people. Unfortunately, in recent months, we've seen politicians saying very nasty comments. So we are afraid that this might be the beginning of an organized hate campaign against LGBTQI people in the country.
Coca-Cola, in a statement, says it, quote, strives for diversity, inclusion and equality in our business, and we support these rights in society as well. We believe everyone has a right to love the person they choose. How does the Hungarian government feel about those beliefs, and how do they push back against what seems to be a fairly innocuous position?
Well, since 2012, we have a new constitution called the Fundamental Law that defines marriage as a union between a woman and a man. We do have a registered partnership institution granting similar rights to marriage, and the current government hasn't revoked it yet. Of course, marriage is not the only issue when it comes to sexual health or employment and school discrimination or bullying. The current government is not doing anything and is very inactive.
Tamás, how are you treated on a daily basis in Budapest as a gay man? I mean, do you face microaggressions? Do you face overt prejudice?
I do have now a same-sex couple, and he's not from Hungary. We walk hand in hand on the street, and we've never received any physical abuse. However, verbal abuse happens. So we get nasty comments, "How beautiful you look, you faggot." So that is something that does happen if someone is brave enough to hold hands on the street. If you are more discreet, so to say, and just attend gay parties and gay bars, then you can survive, so to say. But unfortunately, if you read the news programs, the really nasty, terrible things, even calling for the murdering of LGBTQI people, even if it's not personally attacking you, you feel quite bad if you have to face it every day.
Tamás Dombos with the Hatter Gay Rights Group speaking with us from Budapest. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's return now to El Paso, where a lot of media are covering President Trump's visit there today. Jorge Ramos with Univision News is in the press scrum. He's probably the best-known Spanish-language broadcaster in the Americas. He's been speaking with residents and loved ones of the victims of the shooting in El Paso and on the other side of the border in Ciudad Juarez, trying to make sense of this tragedy for his audience. I spoke with him earlier today.
What we have here, and it is terrible to say it, but what we have here is the worst, the deadliest attack on Latinos in modern history in the United States. And it's happening right now in Texas in 2019.
We've had so many crises in U.S.-Mexico relations. How is this moment different from the other ones?
For the first time, I sense that some Mexicans feel that it is safer to be in Mexico than to be in the United States. People in Juarez now are telling me that they are afraid of crossing into El Paso, not because of the cartels, but because of racism. And because they tell me if they go to a store in Ciudad Juarez, they will not be killed. But if they go to a store in the United States to a mall or to a public place in the United States in El Paso, they might be attacked.
So the Mexican government is partnering with the Trump administration to keep asylum seekers in Mexico, as you know. I was just speaking with the Mexican ambassador to the U.S., Marta Bárcena, about how that partnership is putting asylum seekers in harm's way in increasingly violent Mexican cities like Tijuana and Juarez, not to mention in detention centers in Mexico that are crowded and frankly disgusting. What do you make of the Mexican government's reaction?
I am incredibly disappointed because I think Mexico and Guatemala are becoming the immigration police of Donald Trump.
Polls suggest about one quarter of Latinos in Texas support President Trump's reelection, and that mirrors his support with Latinos nationwide in the U.S. I mean, I'm guessing you run into some of these Americans. How do you understand their support for President Trump?
The economy is doing great. So that has something to do with it. And I'm also noticing that people somehow get comfortable with racism, with sexism, with xenophobia. Before, in 2016, I still remember that many Latinos were afraid of saying openly that they would vote for President Trump because of what he had said about immigrants, because of what he had said about women and what he had said about immigrants. But now, after having President Trump a few years in office, some Latinos feel a little more comfortable with saying that they're going to vote for President Trump despite his racist statements. And in the last presidential election, about 29% of Latinos voted for President Trump. And I wouldn't be surprised if that number stays the same or even goes a little higher because of the economy. For some people, the economy, Marco, I think it's more important than racism.
Jorge Ramos, you identify as American because you are American, even though you were born in Mexico. Is it getting harder for you to embrace your Americanness?
No, quite the contrary. As a matter of fact, I feel more and more comfortable with being many things at the same time. I am Mexican because I was born in Mexico, but I'm an American by choice. And there's nothing more beautiful, Marco, than being embraced by a new country. This country, the United States, gave me all the opportunities that my country of origin couldn't give me. So I am many things. I am Mexican, I am American, I am an immigrant, and I have to admit it, the incredible freedom that we have. I mean, we spent the last few minutes criticizing the president of the United States, and nothing's going to happen to me. I'm going to go to the airport just to see if I can speak with President Trump, and nothing's going to happen to me. If we were talking about the president in other countries, we could fear for our life. That's not the case in this country. So I love the United States, but I also have to admit that to love a country, sometimes you have to criticize the things that you don't like. You have to criticize the things that are wrong. And racism is wrong, and it is wrong when it's coming specifically from the president of the United States.
Jorge Ramos anchors the Univision News and is the author of Stranger, The Challenge of a Latino Immigrant in the Trump Era. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Finally today, we shift gears to some new grooves from the Malaysian-born singer Yuna. She grew up in Kuala Lumpur and now resides in L.A. She's a Muslim singer-songwriter, but has a hard time being defined solely that way. So Yuna wrote a song about that.
I think I gotta be honest to myself. I could never be anybody else. I could never please everybody else.
The song that you're listening to right now is called Likes.
Toxic candy bar, I will consume it. I made it pretty far, but that's not enough yet.
I wanted to tell a story about what people thought of me, like other people's narratives.
She doesn't smoke, she doesn't show us, get I heard she doesn't drink.
On this side of the spectrum, there are people just like, oh, why can't she just be the Muslim that I know, you know? And this other side is saying, why can't she just be the artist, the musician that I'm used to, you know, like on TV or on the radio, on the magazine. So I wrote this song. It's a reminder to myself to just always stay true to myself and be proud of my identity and not care what other people say about me.
Here's the story of me being true to me. I got the music and faith inside of me. One says just get on with the times. One says you live in an alibi.
So the name of the album is called Rouge, and the reason why I picked that name is because growing up, I felt like I was always afraid of wearing the color red. I felt like it was too bold for me and for my personality, I think. It was just like a really strong color and really brave, and I felt like maybe I'm not there yet, you know? And I said to myself, like, one day I'll be bold enough to, like, wear red lipstick and red jacket, and now is the time. And I really felt that, you know, making this album, I'm really taking risks, and I'm braver now, I'm wiser now, you know? Red is the color of the new woman that I am today, and I'm excited about it. I want to celebrate it, so that's why I picked Rouge.
I thought we were friends.
Yuna's new album is titled Rouge. Her song Blank Marquee takes us out today. The world's theme music was composed by Ned Porter from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow with more news and more music. We'll see you then.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.